Thank you to you both. I'd like to now invite comments and questions from the floor. Yes.
I'm Sarah Hsu, IC Squared Institute at University of Texas at Austin. I have a question for Dr. Bajuri. I was wondering about your model. If you feel that in response to the like downslope moving into the crisis, do you think that it would be a good policy for the government to reduce consumers' stock of debt?
There?
Oh, sorry. I'm Alison Vasconcelos from Ecuador. Following Rania's presentation, I believe it's very difficult to tell about the difference in impacts of, in this crisis in, compared to the other ones, because I mean, women have suffered from effects or impacts from many, many crises, and these effects are multidimensional because welfare and poverty are multidimensional. I would like to ask more about the nature of this crisis compared to the other ones, and give some ideas. If it's this is a demand crisis, maybe it is important to talk about employment and food security and all this. If it's this is a crisis coming from a very unequal or more unequal or differently unequal world than before, or maybe, and that's an issue that I haven't heard enough of, it's a care crisis, meaning not only that care systems are collapsing, but or that, for example, services, state services are reduced, or that this is affecting women more than men because they make this are dedicated to the care work. But rethinking about care economy as not only as a sector of the economy, but as a way to see a different way to see the economy, meaning that maybe the crisis is not only a crisis within the system, but it is a crisis of the system, of the economy, or market economy as we know it. And we need to rethink the economy as a different or different system, or with different concepts or with different principles, including or rethinking about sustainability of the economy, and recognizing that sustainability is not in financial arena, but is in reproductive and productive spheres as well.
I'm Madhu Bhaduri, and I have a question for Dr. Professor Jayati Ghosh. You said that China has been able to circumvent or avoid the food crisis. How come? And that's one-fifth of the global population. So if we know how, it would be interesting. Thank you.
Feridun Kuyuk Amali Levy Institute. Question for Professor Ghosh. I seem to remember a World Bank study which concluded that most of the driving force behind high food prices was switching to ethanol production. Do you have any comments on that, please?
Am I? I have a comment, and I thoroughly enjoyed all the presentations. I just want to say that sort of taking off from the comments made by Butch Montes about how do we advocate for from a gender aware point of view, and how do we advocate for a sort of a rehauling rather than accepting band-aids, as Rania Antonopoulos has been arguing. And it just makes me think that some of the things that we are arguing about or for or advocating for as economists, perhaps not only they really need to be done from a gender-aware perspective, but sometimes the arguments might even be more important or acceptable when they are made from a gender-aware perspective. Now, the reason that they are not accepted so easily is because the gender is not a part of the consciousness of most economists' thinking. But I just want to give three examples. One is the, of course, what Dimitri and others have been talking about, the issue of volatility, instability, and that volatility and instability as something that is systemic, not accidental, not something due to bad regulation or incomplete regulation, but rather as something that is produced by the system on a systemic basis. That's what I understood. And of course, volatility and instability are bad for most people. They are not necessarily bad for the some people who make gains from this, but they are bad for most women and men. But they are really, in many ways, much worse for women because of the fact that they are economically always in a much more vulnerable position. And here there is the technical term of vulnerability I'm using, and they are vulnerable to poverty much more so than men. So stability, instability and volatility is always much worse for women, even for women who are not living under poverty. Second thing is that when we are, for example, talking about things like global taxation, how are we going to do all the things that we want to actually advocate for? This might be buffer stocks, etc., all kinds of other things that might require global taxes and global cooperation. It would be very important to, for example, remind everybody that women actually pay an enormous labor tax in the world economy. Through the unpaid work that they do. They subsidize the whole workings of the system, and it might be useful to enter the discussion from that point of view. Another issue, of course, is the economy. Can the economy be consumer-led, led by consumption as opposed to investment? Again, it would be important to remember that women and men have very different consumption patterns that can be summarized as the good mother thesis. We don't have time to go to that right now. But it might be very important to go through these things that we are advocating as economists, and perhaps we can say that sometimes these are more effective to argue them from a gender-aware point of view as opposed to just a general point.
Thank you very much. One more? Okay. Yes, please.
I have two comments. Okay. I have two comments on gender and Rania's presentation, basically. One is that, you know, whether informal work is a channel of crisis or a consequence of crisis. I think that it triggers a vicious circle of informalization, and it becomes a cause as well as a consequence, and it intensifies the informality of women in the process. Second is regarding one more channel which is very important for developing countries is the environmental channel. Because of the crisis, as a part of coping strategy, women depend on environmental resources which worsens their own livelihood, and that again creates a vicious circle of this. In other words, crisis can initiate these vicious circles and intensify women's poverty and women's vulnerability.
Thank you. I would like to invite the panel to respond. Maybe Rania, you can begin with the questions that were directed to you, and we can just go in order. And then to Nilufer's and Indira's comments, I would invite the whole panel, the entire panel, if there are any quick comments you'd like to offer. Thank you.
Thank you very much for all your comments, suggestions, food for thought, further thought. Very briefly, I want to say two things about how this crisis is different from other crises. In terms of whatever employment patterns we will see ahead of us, the United States, in not only my opinion, from what I understand from many others that are analyzing this, will not continue to be the importer, essentially, of last resort, not the importer as it has been until now. So trade patterns will change, but that, as a wonderful, beautiful paper by Jayati has talked about, provides an opportunity, actually. It's going to be painful to readjust the structure of the economy so that it is not so much export-oriented, and perhaps what was mentioned earlier, that you know, you can start mobilizing whatever technology, resource, etc. you have to see how it can be part and parcel of a new development national regional plan. So I see that as one of the differences. But I want to comment on the second point that you were making. We have been saying for a long time that there is an order of reproduction of human beings, of communities, production that is supposed to be serving the needs of people and communities, and finance that once upon a time was supposed to be serving the needs of production to some extent. But financialization and all of that has turned things upside down. And when we say that the financial sector has been privileged, what we mean is that there have been national and international institutional arrangements that allow, actually, the plundering of the world, the avoidance of taxation, the manipulation of what is in the books, what is outside the books, and all of that, that at the end of the day has cost us all a lot. So this is sort of the diagnosis of it, that this is, okay, this is what is going on. Now, when we say we want a people-centered economy, and Kemal Dervish said something along those lines, a caring economy, a people-centered economy, and everybody is using that, I think that not all of us have the same idea in our minds. From where I stand, although I did not have a lot of time to talk about this, the primary issue for me is to socialize unpaid work so that human beings are treated in terms of responsibilities and extraction of time in equal ways. I think that will bring about a revolution in the lives of women. I think this will be tremendously empowering. It does not mean that employment guarantee little schemes will now do the child caring and everything else. But as we do that, we're going to get away from the term child care, and we will call it early childhood development, because that's what it is. That's what it is. So socializing and mobilizing unpaid, I have seen it, thank you, unpaid labor in order to create the goods and services that will reduce, and the infrastructure and everything else that will reduce unpaid work, that I think is something we have to push, we can push for, and we can sensitize our governments and our organizations to do that. It may happen through the channel I'm proposing, it may happen through a channel that says the government assumes this is a permanent responsibility and entitlement. Then we will all be rejoicing, and we will not need to be screaming, in your employment guarantee schemes, in your employment of last resort, be gender aware. Not only infrastructure, not only roads, there is this other invisible, hidden work that takes place, invisible vacancies, hidden vacancies that can be filled in if and when the government decides that it is their responsibility to become the employer of last resort. But once again, if the public sector assumes its proper responsibility, then it will allow me for once in my lifetime to switch out of what I'm doing and start working in a different area.
Our interpreters, please. I realize we are at the appointed hour to end, but if you could stay with us just a little bit longer as we finish up the Q&As, greatly appreciated. Thank you. And to all of you, I realize we're right before lunch, but there's good intellectual food coming. So.
Yes, well, thank you very much, and I will not take much time because I realize that everybody is tired and there will be a long afternoon following the long morning. I want to first thank Butch for some very thoughtful comments, and since I agree with him, I'm not going to dwell on it further. On Madhu's question, you know, I think China is an exception in many ways. So in a sense, it kind of distorts the picture really to look at China, but it just also shows that it can be done because critical here is both domestic production and domestic distribution. Food grains, China domestically produces between 95% to 98% of the food grains that is domestically consumed, which gives it obviously huge leeway because even with the large population, it's only a small proportion of domestic consumption that is imported. But and of course, it has this huge, shall we say, external power at, in the balance of payments account, so it doesn't have to worry about import in that sense at all. In addition, it has still fairly large controls on domestic distribution, despite all the decontrol. And that is really what allows it to maintain the prices at relatively low levels, despite the increase and decrease. And I think I just want to mention here that, you know, doing that also requires fiscal space. And one of the things this crisis has done has destroyed fiscal space for a lot of developing countries. And to that, the point I didn't make, we can add the role of the IMF, which is still asking the countries that are going to it today for reducing its fiscal deficit. So Pakistan, where wheat prices have gone up by 139%, is being told to cut its public spending by 3% of GDP. So it cannot actually institute a proper public distribution system. And food prices will continue to rise and so on. So I think, you know, all of them are linked in a sense. On the ethanol thing, ethanol is bad news anyway, okay? Ethanol is not even green because, I mean, there are scientific studies that actually show that it actually contributes more to global warming because of the nature of cultivation. So it's not even green. It causes crop diversion. It's entirely subsidy created. It's bad news, okay? Having said that, it was not responsible for the price hike. I mean, we still have those subsidies. We still have the same diversion of acreage and crop production of ethanol. But prices went up and are now down 19% compared to last April. So you can't explain that tripling of the price and then coming down to less than, you know, almost by one fifth compared to where they were a year ago on the basis of ethanol production. And I think that would be, if you like, a classic example to me of World Bank analysis. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you. I would be even briefer, and I have a straight question. What should we do about the consumer's stock of debt? In the short run, I think the standard answer is that you have an asset price. If you have a rising prices of assets, your debt goes down. If you have a falling price of assets, your real debt goes up. So it is through the price mechanism, this is the way you'd operate with this. There is no other known way by which a market can deal with consumers' debt without, you know, changing contracts with the commercial banks. But the point to remember is not this. The point is you cannot actually deal with the symptom, which is consumers' debt. Basically, it is, and that was the main thrust of my lecture, it is, you know, what has Dimitri has said very well, it's a systemic problem. That is, if you reduce the debt in some way by a fiat, it will again accumulate in the current financial system, and you will again have that same kind of oscillation. Minsky put it beautifully, and he could have said it in a very commonsensical way. When the real economy is more or less going steadily, you will have speculation, optimism and speculation, which will destabilize the market through finance. When the economy is destabilized, you will have the economy, the real economy collapsing. And this is what I was trying to say in another way, in a slightly more precise way. Thank you.
Final words, Steve.
I actually have two comments. One refers to what Nilufer suggested in terms of making distinction in terms of the consumer-led growth. And of course, when one talks about consumer-led growth, does not talk about male consumer growth or female consumer growth. I think that if one is to restructure the economy so that growth takes place in terms of consumption, that will include both hidden and visible vacancies. because employment becomes the center of gravity. So yes, your point is well taken, but I think when one talks about consumer-led growth does not actually make that kind of a distinction. The second thing which I think is a little bit important is that what Butch actually suggested, which is that now that international trade flows have dramatically declined, and just to put some numbers together, you know, the international trade flows from the major sort of U.S. trading partners, which includes China, the, India, Brazil, and South Korea, and the rest, have declined between this year's compared to 2008 and 2008 by 15 and 22% respectively. Now, that is substantial decline, which means that export-led growth, it's not going to actually be the necessary ingredient for growth of those exporting-led countries. So therefore, when one endures this great recession, as we say, one has to look at the structural adjustments to change the demand for domestically produced goods. If nothing else, the global imbalances that have been created over the last two decades cannot be sustained. And therefore, one would expect that the international organizations that are charged with the responsibility of running the global economy will look at those things and begin to implement the structural adjustments that are necessary. Thanks.
I just had a short comment. This is provoked by what Rania said, that I think what the gender analysis and the gender politics and the gender area actually brings to the fore is the one of the basic things that's quite important that's coming out of this discussion from the people who are concerned about gender issues is this question that bringing up the next generation is a social responsibility. It's a, not social, but the society's responsibility, right? And every society will have to find a way in which this responsibility has been taken up. But we've seen a real pattern in which most of this responsibility has been thrown off to one sex, right? And has never been has never been in many cases not accepted as a responsibility. There were, as I always say, in the socialist economies, the former Soviet Union, there was some way in which there were some formal institutions that did this, maybe unconsciously or consciously, but that's the kind of thing that's implicit in the fact that the question of unpaid work and the question of bringing up the next generation should actually be a responsibility of the whole society, right? So.
Wonderful. Well, thank you all. As we close now, my thanks to the audience for your thought-provoking questions. My hope is that your intellectual hunger has been satisfied for the moment, as we'll move on to satisfying your physical hunger shortly. Thank you to the interpreters sincerely for staying with us. Your generosity is appreciated. And ladies and gentlemen, please join me in a round of applause to our panel for their intellectual leadership on these important issues.